Okay, welcome once again to another Throttle Up Radio Show and Podcast, and I'm your host, Captain Kevin Smith, and I am glad to be here along with my audio engineer, who is keeping track of me and making sure that I get the right timing and say the right things. Anyway, so welcome. Red State Talk Radio is the radio show that we are on. And we are on the weekends, both channels, both days. You can go to the website and find the exact times. Actually happens to be 6 p.m. and 7 p.m. Eastern Time, but you want to double check the channels for that. Again, it's a weekend show. We are also a podcast. And the podcast is available on most podcast platforms that we are aware of. There's a whole bunch of them. CastBox is one of them. Podbean, iTunes, Apple Play, and the list goes on. Okay. We are in the midst of a special edition, long-running special edition, Think Like a Fighter Pilot, is the series of discussions that we have ongoing for various reasons. We're using that, not least of which is the fascination with the Top Gun Maverick movie, and also the release of my new book, The Sonic Warrior Chronicles of a Top Gun Pioneer, and yes, I am a former Navy fighter pilot and Top Gun pioneer. I was on the ground floor of the Top Gun initiative. And so I have, what would you say, a working knowledge of Top Gun. I was there at the very beginning, at the ground floor, if you will, of this whole Top Gun movement. I call it the Top Gun initiative because it included more than just the Navy Fighter Weapons School. It included a lot of other things that were going on in that time and place in aviation history. And so that's what we have going. Today's talk is entitled Mission Critical. And the reason for that will become obvious as we get into the discussion, but we are going to be discussing things that are mission critical, things that were mission critical, and what we did about it, because we first and foremost recognized that things were becoming mission critical and we needed to do something about it. We needed to take action. We needed to come up with a viable response, a viable solution to the problems that were being presented to us. The problems were classified as mission critical. So we're going to start off the show with my audio engineer reading me a question about that. And so over to my audio engineer.
Hi there, Kevin. And hello to your listening audience. Today's question, what do you mean by mission critical? And why is it important in the realm of aerial combat?
Okay, another great question. Thank you for that. Mission critical, why is it important? All right, so let me set the stage here because just by delving right into a particular problem space, we may lose some of the meanings and some of the depth and breadth of the arguments in the situation. And so let me set the stage first and foremost before I get into answering that question. The first order of business is that we are now, with respect to what I am trying to address myself to, we did actually face, in the realm of aviation, we did face a situation that was, that I classify, and most people do, by the way, classify it as mission critical. We were at a critical point in the field of aviation. Now, let me kind of explain a little bit by what I mean by that. All right, so come with me and enter with me, at least intellectually enter with me, a situation space or a problem space or a battle space. So we enter this battle space together. In the battle space, we are confronted by something that is surprising to us, which is that our understanding of aerial combat and our understanding of things that relate to Top Gun and the Top Gun initiative, our understanding about the technology that is becoming available, our understanding is incomplete. It is often faulty, and it is misdirected, and it is, we can say very, very bluntly, our understanding is fundamentally wrong. Now, I'm going to read from one of the, well, we call them episodes. Now, this is a, now, my book, I'm going to read from my book, the recent book. I've got a number of books out there in the book universe. This book is called The Sonic Warrior Chronicles of a Top Gun Pioneer, and it's organized differently. It's organized into episodes. Episodes are standalone stories that can be read one at a time. They are connected roughly in some kind of a broad logical basis, but nevertheless, episode 4 is called Mission Critical, and I'm going to read from it, not the whole episode or chapter. I'm going to read some of the beginning paragraphs of this, of episode 4 in my new book, The Sonic Warrior, so we can begin to understand what was being presented. What is it that we were being confronted with? We were shocked to realize that some of our beliefs and understandings and some of the things that we put in place were incorrect, were wrong, were seriously wrong, and they were going to lead to mission failure. So unless we did something, we were going to ultimately fail, and this had major implications for national defense. So let me begin this story. It was the summer of 1968. I was at the end of a 12,000-foot runway. This runway was at the Naval Air Station Oceana in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Now, I was waiting for two F-4 Phantoms, which were brand new Navy fighters of the day, to take off in front of me. I was planning to join up with them soon after takeoff. I was not in a Phantom II, but I was in an F-8 Crusader. Now, the F-8 Crusader was roughly a contemporary of the F-4 Phantom II. It was a few years ahead of the Phantom's introduction and was also a lightweight fighter. It carried guns and early missiles, and some of these missiles were called the Sidewinder. Now, after the F-4s took off and broke ground, I was given my takeoff clearance, so I lit my afterburner, rocketed down the runway, took off, and joined up with the flight of the two F-4 Phantoms. We proceeded out to a military operating area. It was off the coast of Virginia in the Atlantic, so it was a fairly large military operating area. In this particular case, we were going to perform air combat maneuvering, more specifically, close-in, high-velocity air combat maneuvering, which happened to be part of an advanced air combat training curriculum. Now, this is the fascinating story of why we were doing this. It is probably one of the most important stories in the history of military aviation. I would go so far as to say it is probably one of the most important stories in all of aviation. As it turns out, this was a very serious attempt to deal with a rather troubling and extremely serious problem, which we classified as mission critical. Mission critical is a term that means that something is very difficult and complex, but it is essential that it be done such that it becomes critical to the mission. We were engaged in the mission critical activities to upgrade the close in air combat skills of the F-4 Phantom flight crews. At that time, the Phantom was a brand new airplane. It was entering the fleet to become the primary air combat fighter for both the Navy and the Air Force. The Air Force was in the process of purchasing a land-based version. The Navy had a carrier-based version, which required different structural modifications for it to perform well in a carrier environment. This story is based upon the prevailing wisdom of the day, which happened to be fundamentally flawed. The prevailing wisdom said that in advancing technology in the field of missiles and missile-oriented technology, air-to-air missiles were going to quickly replace the cannons or guns we carried in other airplanes, such as the Crusader. Advancements were made on a regular basis, and these sophisticated air-to-air missiles, which in some cases were guided, were considered to be more effective in the air combat environment. They were far more lethal and were maneuverable after they left the mother aircraft. It was thought that these missiles were going to replace the guns and therefore negate the need for close-in aerial combat. Now, I'm going to stop right there and reading from this passage in the book, The Sonic Warrior, and make some parenthetical and editorial remarks right now. Right now, you begin to see where this is all leading to. This is leading to a lot of what was presented in both Top Gun movies. The first Top Gun movie, some 30 years ago, as well as the recent Top Gun Maverick movie. Okay, they talk about Navy Fighter Weapons School, which was put together and designed to address itself to close-in air combat training. All right, let me continue reading. The thinking was that the missiles were going to extend the lethality range further out beyond the friendly aircraft or the friendly flight of other aircraft, probably beyond 100 miles. It kind of depends on the era, missile, and particular airplane. The airborne radar systems of the F-4 Phantom was new, and it was a fairly long range. The lethality range of the Phantom was advertised at about 50 miles, maybe further. Some of it was, of course, classified at the time because it was thought that these modern missiles were going to negate the need for any kind of close-in air combat involvement. Close-in air combat training was, in fact, no longer being conducted by the F-4 Phantom community. Close-in air combat maneuvering was quickly going to be superseded by longer-range missile-oriented combat. Now, up to this point, close in air combat maneuvering was a very important skill for all fighter pilots. It was taught and practiced continuously. It involved all kinds of various aspect features, setups, and operational engagements across the spectrum. It was an extremely important skill. It was also very difficult in terms of the ability to perform in that environment because we were dealing with a four-dimensional problem space. Four-dimensional space is basically the XYZ axis plus time. There is an X, a Y, and a Z axis that forms a cube. So you're working within a cubic space. The fourth dimension is time, which is very important. This cube moves and changes shape and moves along the time horizon. You cannot freeze the time. Four-dimensional space is the rather unusual place for any human to be and occupy. From a cognitive system standpoint, a human is not optimized to perform well in a four-dimensional space, but eventually can get good at it over time with training and practice. Okay, now I'm done reading for at least for the moment from the book, The Sonic Warrior, Episode 4, which is called Mission Critical. Okay, so we are confronted with a serious operational, tactical, and even at some levels a strategic problem. What is going on with close-in aerial combat? It was, in fact, moving quickly to the thing of the past. It was going to be replaced by modern, advanced, high technology. It turned out in actual combat operations, that assumption, that belief system turned out to be wrong. It was fundamentally flawed. It was wrong on many levels, by the way, and in many aspects it was wrong. I was there, and the best that I can describe it is, first and foremost, I was surprised that it was even being considered. But I was there, and it was wrong from, like I say, from a number of perspectives. And I guess one of them was that we're kind of quick to buy into something, where we jump to conclusions. I'm not sure exactly why we do that, but we do jump to conclusions. I think some of this was being encouraged by the advancing technology of the day. Now, keep in mind that airborne radar technology was advancing by leaps and bounds, and fundamentally, that was a good thing, okay? I'm not criticizing that. I'm not criticizing anything in terms of technology. I think technology is important, given that it can work in an operational setting. It can work on the battlefield, given that it can work. A lot of technology can't, and so it quickly falls by the wayside. But certain technologies do work. They work very well. At least they seem to be able to work well with certain adjustments and modifications. And airborne radar is one of those technologies that falls into works pretty well category. It doesn't work as well as we would like it to. I think some of the modern technology based digital systems that run our current airborne radar mega systems are much better and more reliable than they used to be. And that's a credit to the industry. and it's a credit to everybody. Okay, now, but airborne radar, and when you hook up the missile systems to the airborne radar, there are certain realities that have to come into play. First of all, is the reality that you are not going to be confronted with a compliant adversary. Okay. You are going to be confronted with a adversary who does not want to be shot down, and furthermore, it wants to shoot you down before you shoot them down. Okay, so the adversary is highly capable. It is what we call near-peer adversary, and it is something that we have to keep in mind. And so it's not, you don't go up there and shoot down an airplane that's flying straight and level. You go up there and you attempt to shoot down an airplane that does not want to be shot down. Okay, and so that leads you into all kinds of difficult situations that you have to address yourself to. Okay, so we have the airborne radar. We also have the aircraft itself. The aircraft has been advancing very dramatically over the course of the last 20 years or so. We've gone from propeller airplanes to turbojet-powered airplanes, from straight wing to swept wing, from non-afterburner to afterburner equipped turbojets, and of course a combination of weapon systems that we call guns and missiles. And so most of the at the time, most of the modern airborne fighter aircraft weapon systems were placed upon a modern airframe that was extremely capable and lethal in the airborne battle space. Okay, so that's where we are. And then we are confronted with the fact that, oh, well, wait a minute. The radar missile technological combination has some limitations to it. Some of them are systems limitations, and some of them are limitations of the physics and the dynamics of the environment, and not least of which is the laws of physics come into play as well. You can't violate the laws of physics. Cannot be in two places at the same time, those kinds of things. Okay, yeah. So there was that reality that we were confronted with, and that I was confronted with at this time and place. Okay, so what do you do? Well, first and foremost, you have to then rethink the basic going back to the basic assumptions, going back to the basic premises, and going back to the basic model of reality. Was all of that stuff accurate? Was it sufficiently realistic? Was it something that we can build upon? Was it viable? Was a model of reality viable? And as it turns out, it wasn't. The model of reality that we created was technologically focused, and it was not reliable. Okay, it fell apart under certain conditions. So we had to go back and say, okay, well, the model of reality that we constructed was wrong. All right, so we have to reconstruct one that is more accurate, certainly much better in terms of accuracy and realism. What is it? Well, we have to account for those situations in which the enemy is able to defeat us at long range and enter into the battle space that we represent as close-in aerial combat. So the battle space that we represent as close-in aerial combat needed to have weapon systems that were optimized for close-in aerial combat. It makes sense, doesn't it? Absolutely. Okay, what were the weapon systems? What are the weapon systems that are optimized for close-in aerial combat if, in fact, that has not gone completely away? The only weapon system that we know of right now is a ballistic weapon system. We actually call it guns. Now, that goes back to the Old West, but we call it guns. As it turns out, they weren't guns so much as they were cannons. The airplane I flew had 20-millimeter cannons. There happened to be four of them embedded within the fuselage of the F-A Crusader. So the F-A Crusader had guns and missiles, but the guns were actually 20-millimeter cannons, okay? And what are they? They are ballistic, all right? They shoot a ballistic projectile. Is it guided? No, it's not. It's not guided once it leaves the airplane, okay? So you have all kinds of things that have to be attended to, not least of which is the aim point, the lead pursuit intercept, and all kinds of things, determining the attack plan. It becomes a very, very complicated, multi-dimensional situation or problem space in which an effective solution has to be determined very, very quickly. And when I say very quickly, it's a matter of seconds. You have to figure out what is the most effective solution for this setup, for this battle problem that you have encountered. Okay. Now, that gets us into the discussion, and this is something that it was initially neglected. It was subsequently considered, but more or less as an afterthought. It was not central to the discussion. And that happens to be, what about the pilot? Okay, exactly what is going on in the mind, in the brain, and the consciousness of the pilot? Is it something that we ought to consider? Is there something that we ought to concern ourselves with? Is it something that lends itself to improvement? And last but not least, is there something there that we can actually optimize so as to ensure mission success? Can we optimize the way that the fighter pilot thinks during the course of this battle engagement, during the course of conducting aerial combat or air combat maneuvering? Is there something with respect to the cognitive system that we call the mind of the fighter pilot, or the title of this series is Think Like a Fighter Pilot? Is there something that we can or we ought to consider with respect to that? Okay, now we're getting into an arena here that is largely uncomfortable for most large organizations. Institutional thinking doesn't really lend itself to this kind of brainstorming activity. Institutions don't like people to brainstorm. All right, they just don't. That's just the reality. Now, I'm not saying that they shouldn't. Absolutely, they should. Okay, they should encourage brainstorming, but they don't, and that's the reality that we are faced with. But that notwithstanding, what do we need to know? How should we consider, or better yet, how should we think about what is going on in the mind of the fighter pilot that can effectively achieve mission success during close-in aerial combat exercises, during close-in aerial combat operations against a near-peer enemy? Okay. What is going on? In other words, another way of saying that, and I have mentioned this before, how do you achieve mission success in a high-velocity world? How do you do that? All right, so here we are, close in aerial combat. The adversary is a near-peer adversary, all right? It's an enemy combatant that is highly skilled also. It might be flying a fifth-generation fighter that was discussed in the Top Gun Maverick movie, which are highly effective weapon systems. They have features that other airplanes don't have. And what is going on in the mind of a fighter pilot, or better yet, what should be going on so as to achieve mission success, or at least have a high probability of succeeding in combat, what should be going on? All right, so first and foremost, obviously, is that the fighter pilot, or the mind of the fighter pilot, or how he thinks, the fighter pilot should be mission-focused. Okay, everything should be mission-dependent. It is not ego-driven. It is not personality-driven. It is not fear-driven. It is mission-focused. The accomplishment, the completion of the mission is paramount. Okay, what is that? Because we are engaged in something that is mission-critical. Okay, now, let me explain or expand upon that for just a second. I meant to do this earlier, and I got sidetracked. But I wanted to take a moment and to think about, okay, what is it about a large-scale dynamic system that I need to know? Okay, in terms of systems behavior, in terms of general systems theory. Okay, you can think of it in this way. Number one is that there are, within this broad-based system, there are normal operations. There are things that operate under normal conditions. And then there are things that are going on that are not normal. So it operates under conditions that are not normal. And finally, we go to things that will present chaos. And so we go into a situation in which chaos prevails. All right, it becomes chaotic. Things become chaotic, and the system is starting to demonstrate or manifest chaos. Lots of confusing things that are occurring simultaneously, a lot of ambiguity there, and so chaos is now the order of the day, and eventually, if that is not being taken care of, eventually catastrophe will occur. So we have normal, not normal, we have chaos, and then we have catastrophe. So we have four conditions. Okay. It's very easy in the area of air combat to go from normal to chaotic. Okay. That's where everything seems to be breaking down. You lose sight of lots of important things. You go into a dead man spiral. Okay, you experience G-lock. That's the term for G onset loss of consciousness. That was depicted in the Top Gun Maverick movie, if you remember that. G loss of consciousness. What happened there? That was an onset of chaotic conditions, okay, leading to eventual catastrophe. All right, so we go from normal to adverse conditions to chaotic conditions to catastrophic situations or looming catastrophe. So that's the continuum that I want you to visualize in your mind as we're talking about that. So we have an intellect. We're dealing with the fighter pilot's mind, the mind space of a fighter pilot that is mission focused. It has to be mission focused. It also has to be agile. What does that mean? Well, it means that, right? It cannot be rigid. It's got to be agile. You got to be very, very flexible, agile. You have to be willing to make split-second decisions and make adjustments very, very quickly within the space of, we're talking about seconds. Sometimes we're talking about portions of a second, but certainly we're talking about seconds here. There's not a lot of time, all right? So we have to be able to do that. So the cognitive system that we have on our shoulders, if we are in fact the fighter pilot flying in close in aerial combat, our system has to be agile. Okay. We also have to be creative. Creativity is important. We have to be innovative. Innovation and creativity, they go hand in glove. That has to be part of our capability within our mind space. A mind space has to be capable of that. We have to be ingenious. We have to be, of course, courageous. All right, we have to exhibit intellectual courage. We have to be committed not only to the mission, but also to other higher order things like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, like things that are embedded within the U.S. Constitution, which we took an oath to uphold and defend, and things like that. We also have to recognize that there's a place for teamwork. Now, this is brought out very, very clearly in the Top Gun Maverick movie. Work as a team. Okay, teamwork. Don't leave your wingman in the dust like one of the characters did in the initial training phase of what was happening in the Top Gun Maverick movie. Okay, now, within all of this stuff, we're dealing with what we call war at sea. Okay, war. What does that mean, war at sea? Well, you know, when I was a Navy fighter pilot deployed aboard the aircraft carrier USS Constellation and other carriers as well, we did a lot of war at sea preparations and exercises. We did. Okay. War at sea was a huge part of our ability to win World War II in the Pacific. Our ability to conduct war at sea better than our adversaries. War at sea involves carrier operations. That's front and center. The aircraft carrier is the major weapon system that we employ when we are engaged in war at sea. And the aircraft carrier contains a number of combatants or a number of combat resources that can become airborne at a short period of time, often at a moment's notice. Okay, what are they? There are lots of airborne resources, if you will, or combat platforms that can be launched from the deck of an aircraft carrier. That's what makes it such a powerful weapon system. The aircraft or the weapon systems that I'm talking about specifically are the fighters or the fighter type weapon systems. We call them fighters, okay? And the pilots that fly these weapon systems are called fighter pilots, okay? There are other weapon systems that are employed. There are the attack pilots flying the attack airplanes. That's the air-to-ground systems that are capable of dropping bombs and shooting missiles to all to the ground targets. Fighter pilots are generally employed so as to engage in air-to-air combat and to defeat airborne enemy assets. That's what a fighter pilot typically does. That's pretty much the job description of a fighter pilot, is the airborne battle space, if you will, or the airborne battle problem. What is it that that fighter pilots do? Fighter pilots engage airborne enemy platforms and neutralize them, defeat them, destroy them. Common term is shoot them down. Okay, that's what fighter pilots do. Okay, so, and then we have two very important aspects of the, what I could call the airborne battle space. Okay, the modern airborne battle space includes two additional considerations that are, in fact, mission critical. All right. The first mission critical thing we addressed ourselves to was to return to close-in air combat expertise. We had to return to that. We had to develop something that had previously been lost, which is close-in aerial combat capabilities or expertise. That was lost. We had to regain that. And so we did that because that was mission critical. And I was doing that when I launched from the Naval Air Station Oceana and met two F-4 Phantoms over the air combat training range over the Atlantic. We were going to be engaging in, hopefully I said that right, we're going to be engaging in close-in air combat exercises so as to upgrade their capabilities against a high-velocity, maneuverable adversary that was on a par with their capabilities within the confines of their skill sets and the airplane that they were flying. Okay, so two of the key elements here to mission success, or two of the key elements here that were mission critical to the to being able to achieve mission success in this battle space was velocity and energy. Okay, so we had to be able to manage, if you want to be successful in this arena, you have to be able to manage the high velocities that you can achieve, and you have to be able to manage the elevated energy levels that you can achieve as a result of the high velocities that you are capable of. Okay. in this battle space, we're dealing with these second and third generation fighters. We're basically we're dealing with supersonic capable aircraft. All fighters today, from the very beginning of almost the very beginning of the jet era, this was back in the, you know, somewhere in the mid-50s to the early 60s, all fighter aircraft were supersonic capable across the board. This is true for the Navy as well as the Air Force. In many cases, they were using similar airplanes, or they were using the same airplane. Okay, so supersonic flight has been with us for a long time. Our ability to manage that high levels of energy and the very high velocities associated with those airplanes that are capable of not being slowed down by the sound barrier. Okay, another way of saying that is supersonic flight. That's been around for a long time. What is not well understood, even up to the present time, is the ability to effectively manage that environment, to the ability to optimize performance when you're dealing with high velocities and elevated energy levels. How do you optimize performance? Okay, now, this is where where we had a divergence of opinion. Okay, now this is where I deviated from conventional wisdom. Now, but when I say I'm talking about when I was an active fighter pilot, when I was actively engaged in the Top Gun initiative, and when I was performing as a sonic warrior, that is flying aircraft capable of supersonic flight, I deviated from conventional wisdom. I came up with an alternative understanding of how to optimize performance in the supersonic airborne battle space. Okay. In which close-in aerial combat was, in fact, necessary. In other words, long range was not an option for, we could just say, for various reasons. It was not an option, or at least we had to be trained to perform well in the close-in air combat arena, because it was possible that the long range battle space was not going to be a reality. All right, so I deviated from, another way of saying that is that I came up with an alternate idea or set of ideas for optimizing performance when engaged in close and aerial combat. Now, my idea was, determine, or how do you figure out, or how do you consider exactly what is going on the first time you detect the airborne enemy forces? How should you consider such a thing, and what are the things that you need to relate it to? Just detecting possible radar contact or a possible enemy fighter location in the battle space, that's one thing. The detection is one thing, but how do you make sense out of it? How do you relate it to something that is more meaningful? So I came up with a more of an analytical approach to that very question. the analytics, we can say that what was I using? Well, I was along with a couple of other mavericks, if you will, or outliers. I was using some analytics to try to understand analytically what was going on at first encounter. Okay, what is it that we need to understand when we first encounter an airborne enemy force? What is the first thing? In the past, it was like it was considered to be something that was just ad hoc, one-off. It was kind of a knee-jerk reaction kind of a thing. There wasn't a lot of attention being paid to looking at it analytically, utilizing what I call the analytics of uncertainty. All right, now that's a whole new subject that we have touched on briefly that we probably ought to get into again in some form or fashion. What exactly is the analytics of uncertainty? And I'm noticing from my audio engineer that I have less than a minute. Did you say I have less than a minute to go before the end of the show? All right, so what was the analytics that we were using? And can we understand the airborne battle space better by utilizing certain analytical concepts to help us understand how we can gain the advantage once we detect the airborne enemy forces? And the answer happens to be yes, we can do such a thing, and we have done such a thing in so much as we have proposed it formally and officially to the aerospace industry. Okay, so that completes another Throttle Up radio show and podcast. Thank you for listening, and we will see you all next week.